the opportunity to read the story in advance. That's my understanding. Okay. So, Baderech, I found to be a fascinating story on multiple levels. It has writing elements which Agnon uses frequently in other stories. It has serious biblical influences. He borrows language from Tanakh, he borrows language from Talmud, he borrows language from Tefillah, from our prayers, and I'm going to give specific examples. A lot of his writing in general talks about the Jewish community in a period of diaspora, and particularly post-war, and we see that here in the story as well. The train imagery, which is what sets up the story, is common for Agnon, but you know, you're an Agnon group, you know Agnon better than I do, so you don't need me to tell you these are elements of his writing. But I want to first note that the writing is so evocative of elements from Jewish tradition, and particularly elements that enrich the imagery of the story and where he's going with the story. One of the key themes, which we're going to come back to, oh, by the way, because I sent it in the email, but I didn't say it now, interrupt me, please. Ask questions, make comments, disagree, whatever, but please do, for two reasons. Number one, because that's what I enjoy, and number two, because I'm getting over a cold and I have a sore throat, so it's good for me if you interrupt me from time to time. One of the images that's so important, or not really an image, but one of the elements of the story that's so important, is the fact that it occurs when? When does the story happen? It begins Erev Rosh Hashanah, and it plays out between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Right? This period of the high holidays, Yamim Noraim, is central to the story itself, and it's brought forth in the images he uses. And when he wants to say it's the night before Rosh Hashanah, what does he call it? He doesn't just say it was the night before Rosh Hashanah, right? Erev Zechor Brit. Now, what in the world is Erev Zechor Brit? One of the slichot, one of the key slichot in some communities, the night before Rosh Hashanah, is Zechor Brit, remember the covenant, and it speaks of the covenants that God has made with the Jews. So he calls it Erev Zechor Brit, the night of this slicha, which was a term that was used, particularly in Hasidish Europe. You saw this phrase used for the night before slicha. He uses a phrase at one point.
So you mean the night before Rosh Hashanah?
Before Rosh Hashanah, what did I say?
You said it's before Slichot.
Oh, well, actually, it's funny because the title is also used for the first night of Slichot. Oh, okay. But no, he's using it for the night before Rosh Hashanah. I don't know if you have copies of the story. It doesn't look like it. Some do, some don't. But when he talks about the night, and he says that the halel hikasal of an Elohi ira, it was dark, there was no moon, the moon did not provide illumination, and of course that's true because it's the end of the lunar calendar month, and therefore you're not going to have a visible moon. But he says there, the entire land was like a single entity of darkness, a unit of darkness. Nichnasti l'toch nikrat hatsur. And I entered Nikrat Hatsur. So Nikrat Hatsur, you could read it, and I'm sure they translate it along these lines, as some kind of a crevice in the stone. Right? That would be a literal translation. But if you're familiar with biblical text, you know what is Nikrat Hatsur, right? Kitisa, right. It's after the golden calf, after the Egel, when Moshe has succeeded in acquiring forgiveness for the Jews, and he feels now's his moment to approach God, and he says to God, show me your glory. And God says, I'm going to place you b'nikrat hatsur. And then I'm going to pass by. You can't see my front. You can see behind. It's the place in which one is intimate with God. Again, this element of the high holidays, this time of being very close to God. When he talks about the people he encounters, these Jews he encounters as they're walking in the hills, and he describes their garb. One thing really caught my eye in his description. He says, Ketonet is on page 213 for those who have the text. He says, Ketonet levanal bigdehem. They had a white ketonet on their garments. Umitznefet levana berosham. As well as a white mitznefet on their heads. What is a ketonet? It's a long shirt, essentially, but well, the white is a kittel image, but it's worn by the priest, it's worn by the Kohen in his service in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, and specifically on Yom Kippur, they wore lavan. They wore white. The Kohen Gadol had special white garments that he wore instead of the usual gold ones, because he didn't want to evoke the gold of the golden calf. And instead, he has the white of purity, and yes, that comes out in the kittel that's traditionally worn that day. So he describes them wearing the white ketonet. By the way, he also, the other ketonet in Chumash is Yosef's ketonet pasim. So if you're interested in the connection between Joseph's, coat, the ketonet, and the ketonet of the Kohen, if you go to a synagogue that has Toronto Torah distributed there, which is a bulletin that our main midrash puts out, the front page article, I wrote it. This week is, in fact, on the connection between the ketonet of Joseph and the ketonet of the Kohen. But that's not the point here. The point is, he has them wearing the garments of the Kohen. The ketonet, the mitznefet, which is the hat
of the Kohen.
Of the Kohen, precisely. And then, he had one other item. Ritzu'ah shel kesef, a strip of silver. Rechavah shtei etzba'ot, two finger breadths wide. Makifat ha-mitznefet, which surrounded, or literally bordered, the hat, bordered the mitznefet. If you take a look on your sheets, because I just realized that I haven't been referring to them, I passed them around and there should be some left, because I made the 20 I was suggested to make.
Sorry.
That's fine. So you see, I skipped source number one, but that was the verse about the cleft in the rock, Nikra Tetzur. But in source number two, you find the Talmud's description of this tzitz, which is worn by the Kohen Gadol, by the high priest. And it tells us, tzitz kimintas shel zahav, it was a sort of gold plate, not silver. Verocha shtei etzvaot, and it is two fingers wide. Umukaf meozen laozen, the same word he used in the Hebrew. It extended from ear to ear. The same imagery. Why he goes from gold to silver, I'm not sure. Whether it was because, again, avoiding the gold of the golden calf, even though on Yom Kippur the Kohen Gadol could wear this, or whether it's because he wants to, as part of another element in the story, talk about the Jews as being in exile, bless you, and no longer having gold anymore, and therefore it's sort of a step down for them to have silver. I don't know why he went from gold to silver, but it's so clear when he said two finger breaths, and he uses the word mukaf, and he puts it with the ketonet and then it's nefet. It's so obvious to me, at any rate, obvious to me, meaning it could be dead wrong, but I think so, that he's referring to the garment of the Kohen Gadol. And not only that, he has this really interesting point where he describes them, same paragraph, further down. He says, V'roshan mechusav mitznefet levana, their head was covered with a white hat, asuya kimin kaf ashurit, formed like an Assyrian letter kaf. So we have in the Talmud a distinction between two Hebrew alphabets. One is Paleo-Hebrew, an original Hebrew alphabet, not the one that we use today. And the one that we use today is called the Assyrian alphabet. And he says it was shaped like a kaf in the Hebrew alphabet. What in the world is he talking about? A hat shaped like a kaf? I believe he's referring to what I brought you in source number three, a passage again from the Talmud, where it talks about how you anoint kings and priests. And it says, Ketzad moshchinet ha-malachim, how do you anoint the kings? Kimin nezer, you put oil on their head in the shape of a crown. Ve'et ha-kohanim, and how do you anoint priests? Kimin ki. Now, ki there, as the Talmud continues, is actually either the Greek letter ki, meaning it's an X, or a kaf ashurit, the kaf, which is what he's taking here in it. In other words, he's describing them as being anointed like the priests. He's throwing all of this in there, and I sort of wonder, who is he writing for? Who does he expect to read this and break down his images? You know, but it's, I feel like he should have written with footnotes. You know?
But they have now annotated sort of material.
Yeah. Well, that would have made a lot easier for me.
You could
That's
do one,
cheating.
Since you've already done all this work, you could submit it, I can tell you to whom, with your annotations, because you're right, Agnon has to be with commentaries, annotations. So.
One day. Sure. One day. One other note within it. He continues a little further along, and he says, I'm going to find where I had it. Yes, on page 214, when he talks about the signs of the butchery that had taken place. I'm working with the Hebrew text. It's the end of the paragraph that starts with the Ganu Lechurva, the end of the second paragraph on 214. He says, there were signs of the blood, karush, congealed there, from the holy ones, asher higia damam al haparochet, their blood had reached the curtain. That, to me, again, it's to me, is a clear reference to source number 4, passage in the Talmud, when they discuss the service of Yom Kippur, in which the Kohen Gadol is supposed to bring blood from two offerings, a bull offering and a goat offering, into the Kodesh Kadashim, the Holy of Holies, and sprinkle it towards the curtain. And the Talmud records a debate as to whether it was on the curtain or not. And look what it says. Kishu mazeh, when he does the sprinkling, eino mazeh al haparochet, ela kineged haparochet. He doesn't sprinkle on the curtain, but opposite it. The blood is supposed to be opposite it, towards it. But then Rabbi Lazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, comes along and he says, no. Aniri iti habaroni. I saw this in Rome. I saw the curtain in Rome where they had taken it, you know, when they sacked the temple. And it actually had the blood on it. And when they discuss this in the Talmud, the term used for the blood reaching it was higia daman, and that's actually used in a couple of different places, the same term that he used. So number one is he uses this imagery, he uses these quotes from the Talmud to build up a rich image of Yamim Noraim, the time of the High Holidays, the service done in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. He presents them as priests, and this image of intimacy with God. That's number one. But number two, the image of being baderech, of being on the road. And it shows up in a lot of different ways, but I wanted to just show you three verses that I think he's drawing on. First of all, going back to the beginning, when he describes where the train is, he describes it as Rachok me Adam umeir. Where was he? Let me say that. Ah, sorry, it's page 212. Rachok me Adam umeir. In the first, it's the towards the end of the first paragraph on 212, which literally is far from human being and far from city. Doesn't catch your ear necessarily, except if, like me, you're fortunate enough to have taught the Book of Joshua recently, and then you remember that when the Jews crossed the Jordan on their way into Israel, the water piles up, and take a look at source number 5, he knows it cold. The water that was descending in the Jordan River, descending from above, kamune echad, stood up in one pile for them to be able to cross. Harcheik me'od, far me'adam ha'ir, from the city which was called the city of Adam. So harcheik me'od, me'adam ha'ir, he has rachok me'adam u'me'ir. He's pulling it straight out of Yehoshua. Another, and that's an example of the Jews being baderech, en route, on their way into the land of Israel. Another example, this one is more visible, is when he describes the Jews as, in the next paragraph, as Sep Hizura Yisrael, right? A scattered sheep. That's the way that the Jews are described. That's lifted straight out of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah. I brought it in source number 6 on your sheet. Sep Hizura Yisrael Arayot Hidichu. Israel is a scattered sheep driven by lions, and it's talking about how, as the verse continues, the 10 tribes are driven into exile. They are put baderech, on the road, by the Assyrians, and then the remainder of the Jews by the Babylonians. So this is a different baderech, it's a different road. Instead of being into Israel, it's the way they left the land. And then the third one I noted was at the end of the story, when he talks about going back on his road, he says, Achazti et darki, I grabbed my road. Which you could say is just a nice turn of phrase, except that if you look at source number 7, the book of Job, which I'm teaching now, and I've got some Jobites here, actually. Jobians? I don't know what this is called. But if you look at source number 7, V'yochez tzadik darko, the righteous one grabs his path, sets out on the road. And there it's a figurative path. It's not the physical path of entering Israel or going into exile. It's figurative. But that's very important for reasons I want to come back to right now, actually. So what we see here is he builds up the imagery of the High Holidays. And by the way, like, all I did with this was just like the first part that you see I quoted here, other than one part that I took from the end. You could do this with the whole story. Like, we could spend an hour just going through the references that he's doing here. I did not exhaust all of them. There's so much more that you can do here. But I want to talk about the theme of the story. And you were very flexible in terms of time frame, you know, for how long we go, and I don't want to overstay. So I want to...
everybody stands behind me.
let's wait and see. I don't want to... The theme of the story, What is he really writing about? As I looked at this story, and what I actually did was, in preparing this, I did a trial run. B'nai Akiva has a program on Monday nights with high school students and some of the university students. They hold it at the B'nai Torah Synagogue. Monday night learning. So I went to speak for them for Holocaust Education Week at the beginning of November. And I said, you know what? Try something a little different. I said, I'll do a trial run about this story. Now, it was challenging because high school students aren't going to read a story in advance. They may tell you they did, but they're not going to read a story in advance. So obviously, you have to work things a little bit differently. But one thing that struck me as I was going through it with them is how many different parts there are to this story. You begin, the train breaks down. Then he goes walking and he finds a garden. Then he meets these mysterious people, this apparently holy community when you look at his description. Community of people, and he goes with them. Then you have this odd interlude and Shmuel Levi is dying. Right? The woman comes in to tell them and they say, oh, poor Shmuel, and then they go on with their business. He prays with them. Then he stays with them for the week and he records all sorts of information about their community and about their customs. That's the bulk of the text. And then he leaves to go home. There's so many different pieces to this. And that led me to wonder, if the bulk of the text is devoted to their customs, why does he call the story Baderech? Why does he call the story on the road? You know, when you read this story, what did you think of as the main subject of this story?
He is traveling. He's moving from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he wants to end up in Eretz Israel.
Okay, so he is Baderech. He's the narrator. But is he the subject of the story?
Destruction.
Right? Because?
Because this community was... Not only this, only a few left, but... They've changed all their traditions. They change that, God forbid, something will trigger another pogrom, or another this, or another that.
Right. It's a community that is destroyed on every level, and is just that's their world. They don't. As far as they're concerned, they can't enjoy their child's wedding. If you remember that part in the story, they're completely devastated.
But why are they not enjoying their son's wedding? I was curious.
Digress
too much. So.
No, it's not a digression. I want to come back to it because I think it's important. But I want to get to the role that I think that's playing here. Yeah.
But maybe it's not exclusive to that period of time, which would be either the Crusades or other kinds of pogroms that we know in this. But I think this particular episode takes place in Germany. But I think it's throughout history. It's a repetition. And the fact that he gets at the end, l'mekomi, to Eretz Yisrael, is possible that throughout history this is going to happen until...
Right. And therefore it's a historical derech, effectively.
Yeah, it's not just for that particular
generation.
It's also an imaginative derech, because you're not sure whether what he's experiencing is in his mind, or whether it's real.
Mm-hmm. Right. The whole thing is like, is this a dream sequence? Or is it meant to be real? So really, I kept going back and forth trying to figure out, what is this?
Part of Sefer HaMaasim, which is all very surrealistic. Mm-hmm. There's no distinctions between time and place, and everything is kind of mixed together. So
right.
That's a typical Sefer HaMaasim story.
Okay, so I'm meant to be confused. Definitely. I think that fits into the historical derech, this historical path. I think that's very true. To my mind, the whole story is indeed about these baderech journeys, but in so many ways, on so many levels, and I'm sure I didn't plumb all of them. First of all, there's the physical derech. Right? The physical road. He is indeed on the road. In fact, he is so on the road that his point of origin is not mentioned. And his destination is only thrown in one line at the end. Right? He's as on the road as you can possibly be. But it's also a seasonal baderech. Seasonally being on the road, because it's Rosh Hashanah. That beautiful description that he gave, aside from Erev Zechor Brit, which we talked about before, he said, what was his phrase? I can't do it without his phrase. It was the night of 1 year, the day, you know what I'm talking about? When he said, yeah, Zeh Yom Shel Shana She'avra V'Zeh Laila Shel Shana Chadasha. This is the day of the year that is past. This is the night of the new year. He's on a cusp. It's another type of a derech. It's another type of a journey on the way from the old year to the new. And his road effectively is not just the night, but the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days that lead up to Yom Kippur, that he stays in that community.
Sorry to interrupt. The whole brit, I don't remember it all, but it definitely has a sentence about Alecha Shchutim Mukim Merutim.
Quite possibly. I don't remember the whole text either. But yes.
I mean, remember the covenant with Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but it talks about communities being slaughtered.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that kind of gives you.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, the refrain. The refrain. Zechor Brit Avraham Akedat Yitzchak Vashem Shvut Elke Yaakov, I think. Right? Remember Avraham, remember the Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak, which has an element of suffering too.
And the
I think you're right, although I don't remember the line either. He also has incidental, but I think very illustrative journeys that he brings in. Shmuel Levi. Right? That incident which I read, it's like, what's that doing here? But it's another journey, right? This is somebody who is dying. He is on his way from this world to the next. Sfirat HaOmer, which he throws in. In the story, like, what's Sfirat HaOmer doing? Well, what is Sfirat HaOmer? It's the counting that you do on your way from Pesach to Shavuot. Right? You can ask the question, which is a traditional question of, is it meant to be the Jews' journey from Egypt to Sinai, or is it about the offerings that are brought on Pesach and then the offerings that are brought on Shavuot, two critical offerings, but either way, it's a journey. He's using that within the story to add layers to the types of journeys that people go on, a religious journey, a physical journey, seasonal journeys, life and death. And then in the life of the survivors, because where does he encounter these survivors? Well, they are baderech, right? They are on the road in their own way.
In the mist,
even better. There's uncertainty to it, and the life of the survivors that he describes, which occupies again the bulk of the story, is a life of being baderech. In the beginning, they are baderech in that they're walking to the house of God. Then they're waiting for a minyan, right? It's this waiting. We don't know. Will we have? And they're waiting to die. Right? What struck me, this was an incredible description. The way they built the houses. Right? They sized the door of the house based on being able to take the casket out. Right? I mean, how much more of an anticipation of I am on the derech can you get? You know, it's again a very striking thing.
Are you able to say something about the Omer, that they take out this word every day of the counting of the Omer?
Right, so I saw that.
It's a whole story in itself, so I don't know if it's...
Right, no, I remember writing a note on the side when I saw it. They have a box on the door, and they have the 67th chapter of Tehillim. So we have all sorts of associations with the days of the Omer mystically. So there's a poem called Ana B'Koach, which is a mystical poem, and people associate each day of the Omer with one of those days. There are traits that are really emanations of God, influences of God, called the Sfirot, and each day is a special association. So what he's pointing to is probably, I believe, a European custom, probably again in a Hasidic community that would have been more oriented in this way, where you take a psalm that has 49 words, and each word will have something to do with with that day of the Omer. He focuses a lot on this community's suffering and death they've experienced, but also on their uncertainty in Galut, in exile under hostile governments, and especially how they express it in their prayer. So that's another dimension of their life being baderech. One last aspect of this. There's another layer, a doubled layer of baderech here. I found a paper online. I was looking at this issue of the train and Agnon, and I found a paper by Professor Netta Stahl from Johns Hopkins And she talks about the trade in Avignon representing modernity. In general, the trade represents sort of the modern world. And perhaps, you know, keep in mind, he writes this, I believe, in 1945. So that's my understanding. So trains have a whole other potential meaning, you know, at that point. But perhaps we could see another message here. The narrator was on a train. The narrator was on a modern derech. Right? Modernity broke down. And that enabled him to encounter ancient ones who are on another derech. Leaving one derech, he is able to perceive another. And I think that may be part of what's part of the imagery here
maybe
in this.
Maybe even if he's on that derech, he should keep that with him as he moves on. And
take the old derech along with him.
And then it'll work.
It's very
right.
Make his way back.
Makes sense. Especially because he records everything. Like, he's writing down all the customs and everything else. So
right.
He, in fact, is going to take
so
it with him.
So, you know, just using that imagery and you know, following it through.
Right.
Going to his next era, but using, not leaving go of those past.
Mm-hmm. I definitely hear that.
And, of course, when you're working out, talking about the Shoah and trains, it's also necessary.
Yeah, and it's
I
missed it. So
no, it was subtler, but yes.
That really had sent to many things about one story, the struggle between modern and Western tradition.
Yep.
And his own personal one.
Right, where he goes.
And when we say derech, I mean, we use it now on the off the derech.
Mm-hmm. I mean, right.
It's
right.
It's used nowadays and belongs to a very.
Yeah.
Well, in his own personal life, he had this struggle sometimes.
Right, and I'm going to come back to that, not in terms of Avignon, I wasn't planning on that aspect of it, but in terms of what you're saying about derech being a religious derech, I'm coming back to that in a minute, because what I see here is the baderech life of the survivors is the major point of his story, and he is adorning it, and he's showing different aspects by showing other types of derech that exist, but that's his emphasis, and I think what he's trying to do is help us understand what it means to be baderech. That's what he's showing us. You know, within our own lives, you know, what does it mean to be baderech? What does that mean when we're on the road?
Alive,
maybe. Expecting something, living in anticipation. What else?
Moving up one stage.
Up could be one way. The escalator goes down also. Is that part of baderech?
We're on our way until it's the end of our life.
Yes.
And also being in an unstable situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Instability. The are we there yet anticipation. Discomfort. Right? Generally speaking, someone who is on the way somewhere, even if they're traveling in relatively luxurious, you know, settings, nonetheless, there's an element of I'm out of my element. I don't have the comforts of home. I'm, you know, stuck on the way. You don't have the access to the usual elements of your life when you are baderech. In Torah, there is a negative connotation to being on a derech as well. If you take a look back at the sheet, at source number 8. This is a midrash that's dealing with God's promise to Abraham. After God tells Abraham, I want you to go, leave your land, leave your family, and so on, he then gives him a blessing, and he says, I'm going to make you great, I will make you successful, you will have children, and so on. And the sages looked at that and said, why is God giving him this blessing here? He's going to give him a blessing later. Why is this blessing here, right after God tells him to get on the road? And they say it's meant as an antidote to being on the road. Source number 8, Amar Rabbi Chia said, Lefisha derech, he has the word migaremet, we would usually say goremet in our Hebrew, L'shloshan devarim, the road causes three things. Mema'edet pirya v'rivya, reduces procreation, there's not the opportunity to produce a family. Mema'edet la'yitziya, it reduces commerce. U'mema'edet et hashem, and it reduces one's reputation, because no one knows you. It's a negative for a person to be on the road, and it's also a strain. I brought you source number 9, the last of the sources on the sheet. Rabbi Elazar says, He says, if you come in off the road, don't pray the Amidah for 3 days. You're too distracted. Now, the sages afterwards revisited that and said, you know, if you tell people that, they're never going to pray. If they're really worried about getting proper concentration, we're never going to get them into the shul. And our travel is, frankly, a little better than the conditions Rabbi Elazar had. And he wasn't talking about going to the store. He was talking about, you know, an extended trip. That's my understanding. But the point is that there's strain involved in being baderech. Now, there are positive drachim, positive paths in Torah also. I think it was mentioned before, derech can be a path of growth. Like, for example, the 3-day derech on the way to the Akedah, to the binding of Isaac, is understood as a period of growth for Avram and his son Yitzchak. When Yonah goes into the city of Nineveh, there are 3-day periods, particularly 3-day periods, but there are drachim that are of growth. And of course, you can't skip, and this goes back to your point about derech. The Torah says that God sends Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, out of the garden, and he appoints these kruvim, cherubs, whatever cherubs are, to guard derech etz hachayim, the derech to the tree of life. And later on, we are told that Hashem loves Avram because he will train his children, vishamru derech Hashem, to guard the path, the derech of God. And the Jews are instructed, v'halachta b'drachav, you shall walk in the derech of God. So there are positive uses of derech throughout the Torah, and that's where the phrase off the derech comes from.
Where
someone
does
who,
derech ha-yashav come from?
I think it's a rabbinic phrase. I don't think it's biblical. The phrase derech ha-yashav, I believe.
It's just directions are in Israel,
yashar. Right. Right. People maybe not always, but definitely the... But in the story here, I don't see him invoking the positive ones. I see him invoking the drachim of trouble, the drachim of dislocation, the drachim of discomfort and of danger and of hesitation. The derech here is one of being unsettled in between worlds, like the traveler, like Shmuel Levi. The derech here is of being out of place, and that brings me to the wedding.
I thought it was
like goals. Yeah, it is, absolutely.
100%.
Absolutely.
He wrote it in 45, right? So he talks at the end about going to land of Israel, so he was already...
He's already in.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And from personal experience, getting stuck in a train in the middle of the night, it doesn't move. And it's very distressing right there.
Right. Absolutely.
It happened to me.
Absolutely. And certainly in the days before cell phones.
It was
the days before cell phones.
Yeah.
Okay.
I also find it interesting that the name of the person who died is Shmuel Alevi, and his name is Shmuel.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Which is Avnon's name.
Yes, I wondered about that. Is it autobiographical? Is it
maybe the new Derech died and he went back to the old Derech?
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Or the Derech of the Galut died.
Right. I definitely hear it. This brings me to the wedding, right? And the couple who are at the wedding, and she goes out, and she sees her husband there, and he says, "I can't bear all the noise." Kol Arash, it's page 216. And he's so low, and she says, "Okay, so now Zolabetenu, let's go home. Yeah, we don't have to be there. It's their son's wedding, but they're not going to be there." They feel out of place. They feel like they don't belong. To me, it's another demonstration of being out of place in this world, of being en route somewhere else. You don't belong, you know, where you are right now. They're isolated. You know, that's emphasized at the beginning when he talks about being in a place where there are no people found. He notes at the start that there is a derech which is more enjoyable. Right? In the beginning, he says, you know, if this wasn't the night before Rosh Hashanah, I would have enjoyed the chance to just go wandering and walking aimlessly, and that would have been good. It would have been tiyul. But tiyul is not derech. You know, those are two different things. Tiyul is a destination. I'm happy being on the road. The derech means I'm here in order to get somewhere else. That's the idea. It's also the poverty of it. It's the fear of it that plays such a role. Page 217 through 219, you see their fear. This is what, to me, what he's trying to convey to the reader. He wants the reader to absorb and understand the different ways in which people feel and express this kind of isolation and dislocation. And the life of the Jew in Galut, in fact, is this baderech. A Jew is meant to be, by our tradition, on a spiritual baderech that's going to be happy. Right? The Talmud has a line in which it says, you should never say to somebody else, lech bishalom. You should only say lech lishalom. Because David tells us shalom, lech bishalom, and the end isn't good. The lech lishalom, go towards shalom. And the classic explanation of that line in the Talmud is, you tell someone lech bishalom, shalom connotes shlemut. You're already complete. You don't have any growth to do. Tell people lech lishalom, go towards completeness, towards perfection, to continue to grow. That's where you should, that's the type of badera that we want. And we have mitzvot that celebrate that kind of existence. This counting of the Omer that he mentions, going towards Shavuot with its symbolism of receiving the Torah. The baderach of the Sukkah being with God's protection, right? The baderach of Aliyah L'Regel, going to Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash. But the survivors in this story are stuck with this negative baderach, and that's the very real life that they have, and that in this baderach existence, which is manifest in their lives as, you know, not now talking about the survivors in the story, but survivors in general, in their life as immigrants, in their trauma after the events of the Holocaust, and the brilliance of Agnon, to me, is that he captures that tenuousness and that fear without really having gone into, in any depth, the horrors that they experienced. You know, we had references, but he doesn't really go into it at all. And yet, the image that he evokes is so real and so substantive. I was very glad when writing this up that at least he provided a happy ending. That at the end, he's on a good derech, he's on a happy derech, he's headed home to Eretz Yisrael as the end of the Jews' derech.
But only he, not all the other people.
But only he, they're still stuck where they are.
He represents that new Jew that's coming to Israel. He's sort of the icon.
Right, but to address Ralph's question, I think because they're trapped. They're trapped by their experiences. They can't get out of being baderach.
You know, my question...
That's what I see.
Are these living people?
Maybe they're
living. Is this a dream?
Well, again, we come back to the surreal aspect of this. I don't know.
This imagination.
Right.
Entirely possible. Entirely possible.
The tragedy when all those people were murdered in Sibon. Now, what holiday was that? This is what I was wondering.
So Shavuot is in Sivan.
What?
Shavuot is in Sivan, but
classically,
going back to the Crusades, many of these massacres occurred during Sivan because this is the period after the winter, and they're now able to travel, and therefore the popes would declare their new Crusades at this time of year. And the Jewish communities, who are right along the way, you know the saga, you know the history, would suffer at their hands. So that quite a bit of this happened, and that's why Amar Rachamim, which is a prayer that was created specifically to be recited in memory of the Jews killed in those massacres of the Crusades in the period thereafter. So it was created to be recited on, well, actually at one point it was daily in the synagogue, at one point it becomes Shabbat, and at one point they say, well, you know what, if Shabbat coincides with a holiday, we won't say it. But if it's at that time of year, it's recited anyway. Even if it's a holiday also, Avraham Rachman is said anyway, because that's the time of year when these massacres happen. That's the period of Sivan.
Yeah, and the reason I said I don't know, the white also triggered in my imagination the Tachrichim.
Yeah, it's a valid point. Certainly a valid point. I don't know. And to me, the white gravitated to what I said at the beginning about the Kohen, because I saw so much Kohen imagery and Yom Kippur imagery. But you're right, it's another layer, and I wouldn't put it past him to have both in mind. Yeah?
Are you going to relate to the names that appear in the story? I know Agnon always chooses his names very carefully.
So I didn't think of anything regarding the names. Do you have one in particular that you... I mean, I saw the names there, you know, Revanchel and so on. I did not have any ideas related to the names. I don't know. I think I need to know more Agnon in order to have a better sense of it.
Yeah.
even the Salevi, you know, that is very important to him. We can't do everything, but there's so much details.
Oh, there's so much here. I mean, seriously, just going through the symbols, there was so much more could have done with that.
What do you think of the outside world read his work? How were they able to know what we know, or what you would know, something learned in Talmud? Like, how could they have awarded him all these great honors, you know, without knowing all the subtleties of what he was trying to say? You know? I mean, they obviously, you know?
Right, and the answer is I don't know.
Because in the English, you see,
I read it from my perspective with whatever baggage I bring into it, and they presumably with theirs. But for them, right, he got it in 66, 67?
70, I think,
1970. Is it as late as that? I thought it was late 60s. But at the time that he gets it, it may have had to do with their growing understanding of the phenomenon of the people whose lives were in fact shattered in the way that we see here, and their struggle being baderach, trying to find a place and trying to no longer be baderach. And I think that, as a human condition, resonates with people, even if they don't understand Talmudic imagery and biblical references.
But it's based on his larger novels,
yeah,
which are not as anchored in Jewish tradition. They were more personal stories.
But
right.
Still, the text had an awful lot.
That's right. They missed it. I want you, you know, they missed it. Or
well,
I've noticed. You know,
well,
pointed them out.
I would suggest that by that time,
yeah,
if they wanted to, there was scholarly works already.
Right.
So you say, oh, because he didn't. They didn't just find him and gave him up. You know, this kid, you know, there was a nomination, there was a campaign to get him in, you know, and luckily got him what he did, because today he wouldn't have gotten it.
I don't know. It depends. You know,
he'd have given Israeli the Nobel Prize.
Oh, you're talking about politics. But I mean, as far as his art is concerned, his work, it's always going to be tops and deserving of a Nobel Prize. But you're right, politically speaking,
right,
with, you know, no Jew is going to get a Nobel Prize.
But
I can say to Renee about you saying why they would. I remember reading Agnon and knowing how remote it was. We were never even taught Agnon when I went to Hebrew high school.
Right.
It just was too high up. And there's a book now on Corey, I'll give you that information, has 50 pages on why they didn't teach Agnon in Europe, in a big city like Tarnow that had a fabulous day school, Hebrew school, day all along. The principal did not discover the idea of teaching Agnon until 1939. Every year he would go from Tarnow to Israel and bring books back. And in 39 he was with some kibbutzniks, I think, and who didn't have any religious background. And he couldn't believe how they worshipped Agnon. So he started looking at it, and he shipped a huge, huge shipment of books to Tarnow in Poland in 1939 in September, and of course nothing happened. But only then did this principal, I mean a very enlightened Jew, discover what Agnon was. And I have to say personally that I heard about Agnon, I was more or less, you know, interested. It didn't hit me until one day I visited Bet Agnon, and I went up to his office upstairs, and I recommend every one of you go to his library. It's magnificent, considering, you know, the times. And I saw on the desk there a book by Amos Oz. And I opened up the book, and Amos Oz, whom I considered very witted, you know, and very modern, had a dedication to Agnon. It was like worshipping him. And I thought, what is this? How can he worship Agnon? I mean, he's so anti-religious, he's secular.
He writes a beautiful, a wonderful book, A Tale of Love and Darkness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He writes a beautiful passage where he walks from his own home on Gaula.
And
he walks with his uncle. You saw from the writings of the fact that he's a cross from Agnon,
Amos Oz would have such a great opinion of Agnon, and then Apophel, and who's the Aleph Bet Yehoshua, they all have tributes to Agnon, how deeply they were influenced by him. So the Nobel Prize wasn't just, you know, politics or lobbies. He really deserved. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's my, but I think your husband had something.
Yes, Doreen's question is a very relevant one. As I was listening to the discussion this evening, I was thinking about Canadian content that always interests me. In Canadian English, the term on the road has a slightly different idea connected to it. There's a musical theme connected. Itinerant musicians going from one place to another. Exactly. There's no music in this story, except for the
wedding.
There's not, no music in this story.
Right.
So that's one element that's missing.
In this story, you mean, but there are other stories where the music is very important.
True.
You're right.
Yeah.
I hear that. And the idea of being on the road as a journey of discovery is also, you know, not it's not something that he's talking about here at all.
No.
He has a particular nature of the road experience that he's looking at, that he's exploring. And maybe that's what he means to do when in the very beginning he says, this is this kind of derech. It's not the tiyul kind of derech. It's as if to say, I know there are other things you can do with derech, but in this story, you know, this is the displaced person, the person who can't get home, the person who's there at Rosh Hashanah, and so on. I think that's, I definitely hear your point, and yeah.
When Kitty used the word imaginative narrative, I thought of the word hallucinatory. Kafka-esque. I'm going to throw in also.
Well, certainly. First of all, anytime someone says surreal, you can always throw in Kafka-esque a little bit. But yes, and again, as I said before, I don't know how, you know, whether he intends the reader to view this as a history of events, a diary, or whether it's really imagination, hallucination, whatever, you know, term we wish to, however strong we wish to be in our description of it as imaginative. I don't know what the significance would be of his message, depending on whether it was meant to be real or imagined. It is clear to me that he intends the reader to wonder about this. He deliberately leaves this open-ended. I'm not sure which conclusion we would be meant to draw based on which way we read it.
That's the mark of a good writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hear that.
Well, a religious person, it's like a metaphor. With all the obstacles that you pass in this world, there is one target to go to the other. These words only Geshe Tzameod to come to the destination.
True. And, excuse me, the element of that in Shmuel Levi passing away, you know, seeing that sort of Baderech experience, I think is one place where he emphasizes that. You know, that idea of the Baderech ultimately of reaching the next one. There were hands here.
I was just going to say Baderech is the condition of the human being. But the human being is always on Baderech.
Mm-hmm. The journey of life.
The journey of life. And that's why the general community would accept him and see him as a model.
Right.
Definitely.
Ralph?
Here's another story of Madeira that he calls In the Heart of the Sea. And it's a story about going towards
Il Bavyamim.
Towards
the Eretz
Israel.
On
Aliyah. And on the way, he passes through various communities and describes the unusual customs that they have, especially religious customs. And I wondered if the ones that are in here are as peculiar as the ones that he describes there. Are they out of the ordinary, or has anybody ever heard of them?
I can't compare to the other story without reading the other story. But I found some of them familiar. And then I found some of them, yes, to be, you know, unusual, certainly things that I wasn't familiar with, you know, would not have seen. But they all sounded like. Sorry?
What would be the point of drawing out these peculiar customs?
So, again, I think that part of this really is a record of some customs that are going on in small communities in Europe that we may not be familiar with because, frankly, the communities are gone. You know, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, used to speak on Tisha B'Av about the keynote for hours and hours and hours every year in Boston. And I was privileged now about 15, 16 years ago to be given a bunch of the tapes to transcribe for a book that Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schaffner ended up writing, which collected a lot of the ideas that were in them. So one of the points that he made every year, year in, year out, when he read the keynote, was that the keynote are not just about the destruction of the temple, and they're not just about the suffering that happened then, but these are also keynotes for communities. And he talked about how communities being lost meant all those customs, that whole chain of Jewish tradition that they represented, was simply gone. And that's what Agnon, in part, I think, is documenting here. However, in terms of the significance of the customs he chooses to record, I think that the overall theme in them is fear. Mm-hmm. The overall theme is fear. For example, he says they won't say Aleinu. Right? So Aleinu has been historically a problem prayer for us. On the one hand, it's a national anthem of sorts. We're proud to be who we are. We thank God for the fact that we are who we are. And we worship the true God, and they sure don't. And, you know, one day God is going to make this world one, and his name one, and so on. It's been a prayer which non-Jews didn't really like a whole lot. And there's one line, the classic line, they bow to emptiness and so on, which was dropped in many communities for a very long time. It's still dropped in many communities today because of the sense that it's offensive to people. And today, I think that that's made on a different, for a different reason than it was once. I mean, the reason today may be because there are people who feel it is inappropriate to bash others. Politically or otherwise, but at one point the reason why people eliminated it was because they were afraid of who was going to come knocking on the door, and that's, you know, the omission of Aleinu is one example of it. You know, he talks about saying Abrachim every Shabbat, even if there's a wedding. That goes back to the point that I had made about saying Abrachim and Sivan. They're living this life of destruction. But as you go through it, a lot of these have to do with fear. He has a particularly strange one. The one about reenacting the going from death to life.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he invokes Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein coming to discuss. Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein was the Trumat Hadeshen, a major authority in German Jewry in the 13th, 14th century. It was 14th century. Who wrote about and dealt with these issues in the times of the post-Crusades era of pogroms. But it's all about relations between Jews and non-Jews and fear. That's what I see in the customs that he chooses to mention. You know, the business of Tashlich, and we're not going to go to the rivers because they accuse us of poisoning the rivers. It's all he's choosing customs which either existed or he is creating in order to embellish and emphasize the fear of the Jew who is baderech, who is on the road.
So they better get to his room.
But I don't know what in the world the Nobel Committee would have thought of on reading out the customs. Yes?
I wanted to mention another journey that I just realized now, and I think that there's some mention to the journey of Eliyahu when he goes to Har Sinai.
It's very funny.
In 2:12,
yep.
In the second paragraph, he's talking about the Dimama.
Yes, I was thinking about it when I read the Dimama as well. That I even wrote it on the side there. There's a second reference to Eliyahu there, which is the Nikrat Hatsur.
That's right.
Because Eliyahu was supposed to end up at Har Sinai, Chorev Sinai, called by different names in different places. But but he's in the same place where Moshe was when he had his encounter with God. Now Eliyahu has his encounter with God there. And yes, the Dimama struck me there as well.
And also right there is almost invoking this very, very peaceful imagery. And then we see what happened, and it reminds me of the forests in Europe I was at Babi Yam many, many, many years ago before there was any monument when it was still illegal for Jews to go there. And you're there in this beautiful forest, and what happened? And this kind of reminded me
that's interesting.
Of that.
That's really interesting.
Shem no being for the air of Shalom, you know, the sound of these springs.
Right. I definitely hear that. Thank you. Yes?
In taking this lonely journey with the narrator, I identified or associated most with Jacob. Like when he's on the train, he's alone, completely alone. Well, no, there's a guard and the conductor. And he can't sleep. He tells him, put the satchel under your head.
To rock.
So I think the satchel was the tradition that he carried with him, even though he was on the lonely road.
That's fascinating.
Just like Jacob on the rock, used the rock for his...
That's interesting, especially...
And also, when they come to Dom and Marit, not when they come to Dom, the scene,
yep.
It's Marit, which we associate with Jacob.
Very good.
Yeah.
That's very good, and it's 100% true. If there's anybody in the Torah who lives a life of being on the road... Yeah, well, Moshe lives a life of being on the road for 40 years. But yes, if there's anyone who's on the road in so many ways, you're right on. That is Jacob. The that fits very, very well. Yeah, thank you.
I just want to answer to Ralph one other comment. You find the customs strange, and some of them are strange, but a lot of them, I mean, I don't know anything, but very often I relate to certain customs that I've heard about, and I get the impression that this writing is a memorial to the Jewish past from throughout history. He's not teaching, it's not didactic, but he is memorializing Jewish life as it existed over the centuries. Unfortunately, a lot of it was tragic. So all these customs...
I'm suggesting that it be revived.
No, he's not didactic. He doesn't suggest anything. But he's an artist, you see, and he captures the spirit of what Jewish life has been through the centuries in little pieces here and there. And it's quite beautiful because I don't read it wanting to... I mean, some of the minhagim, the customs, you may want to continue or renew again. But mostly it's he paints a panorama of what it is to be, what it has been for Jewish people through the centuries. Some of it is bloody, like there's a lot of blood and black here, as well as white. But it really is, I don't know if historians may not know it, a lot of Jewish historians were secular. They did not know Talmud or Torah. And he knew Talmud and Torah backward. So he picks up things that you wouldn't find in a history book. But and I don't know how much of it is true, but it's tradition, right? It's a fiber of it, maybe
literature.
Yeah,
I tend to agree with the observation, but what's interesting is what of these tradition with Ms. Minhag he picks up. And it all has to do, in my mind, with the horrible conditions of being in the diaspora, the Golan.
Yeah.
That you're always afraid, you always look behind you.
Even today,
you know, when something happens, our people say, shush, don't make fuss, don't mention it, don't repeat it, don't do, you know, as long as you, what I think that's just, if there is any idea here, is, and that's why I see that going to Israel at the end, you know, and we've seen in other stories, you know, as long as you're in the diaspora, you can't do what you want to do.
Right away, I think that they're doing those things. They hold on to what they are. I mean, it was the Minhagim, because they are in the diaspora, because they're not married to Israel, they have to have these Minhagim, otherwise they're going to be lost completely. So they are, these Minhagim also, you're right, because of fear, but also in some ways it grounds them.
They're survivors.
Well, otherwise they have nothing.
I would note one point in particular that he makes within the story on 219 is he talks about how they don't say zana, they say banim.
That's right.
They don't say tachter, they say banot. You know, they dropped Yiddish in favor of Lashon Kodesh.
That whole passage with the words is very interesting because I've always had disputes and fights with Academia LaLashon HaIvrit, Eliezer Ben Yehuda, Yeah. All these people who invented new modern Hebrew words, and Aglon always wanted to use old traditional, and he's got some really funny things. Lo shel basar ve lo shel chalav, omrim lav lach, lo basar, lo chalav. And anyone who upset you, it was an egel, right?
Right, oh, that was beautiful, very funny.
There are some stories where he dreams about a word, and he goes back to Sfarim to prove that the way he uses the name is correct and not those of the scientists in the university.
That lach, by the way, is lo basar, lo chalav.
Yes. When the Chazan addresses, or was it the Rav, addresses the congregation, and the nine, almost minion, and he doesn't, he uses the word olam, and that's pure Yiddish, oilam, you know? You know, they would stick to everybody in the crowd and say, oilam.
Yeah.
And he would become a Hebrew olam, which I thought was like part of his, you know,
right.
Banim and Banot. But I just wondered, Ari, I'm sorry, I don't mean about the Galut. I should really finish, because whatever I said before about Agnon and the tradition and the Jewish history, there's a very strong, and to me, in my mind, I always separated, there's a very huge shadow of Galut persecution that exists throughout his writings. In some of the happiest notes, you will find suddenly a reference to something about the tragedies, but like here you have a lot of it, you know. But in every story, it somehow comes up. But still, I think there's a lot of glory and tiferet, you know, mm-hmm. the Hebrew tiferet, in his descriptions and in his writing. And he has to, that's his problem. He cannot bring the two together.
There's a great deal of ambivalence about it, I find.
The
thing that jumps out at me is the way he goes back and forth to the remote past and the present, and there's a blurring, and he's talking about the past at certain points as if he was talking about the present.
Right.
And you get a sense of a critique, a loving critique of his fellow Jews, including himself, mm-hmm. who are mired in the past. They can't break away from it. They're still observing these customs from long, long ago, commemorating events that happened hundreds of years ago. Any normal people would have forgotten about it long ago. And they held on to it. And he held on to it. And he made a point of holding on to it. And you see it in all these things that are described, all these literary allusions, mm-hmm. these devices. Mm-hmm. But he can't quite make up his mind whether he wants to remain grounded in the past or he wants to move forward. And right at the end of the story, it's telling that he, from this being in the state of suspended animation, from the time the train gets stuck to the time the train gets fixed, and he moves on and he goes to the port and he goes to Eretz Yisrael, he decides ultimately to move beyond the past that his fellow Jews, we were just with, they were mired in that, they were stuck in it. And he makes up his mind at the end, he's going to Eretz Yisrael, which represents the new Jewish people going to a new world.
I would have, when I read it, I looked at it not as him having volition here. Because he didn't experience what they experienced, he was a visitor from the start. It was never his intent to become part of their community. He was at most a journalist, you know, recording what he saw.
He had a great deal of empathy for it.
Right, but the person...
He understood it and he felt it.
Yes.
But he wasn't quite sure about
it feels like a person who hasn't lived the Derech the way they've lived the Derech, the people he encounters here.
He can't possibly live the Derech the way they did, because he lives in the time in which he lives.
Right, so it's not a matter of...
Not just the time.
But the point is that I don't think he is someone who experienced what they experienced and then moved on. And I don't know, and I certainly haven't read enough Agnon to really, you know, speak about this with any authority. But my sense of it, just from reading here, is that he's not. It's not a statement of they should be leaving this behind the way that I am leaving this behind.
But he's deeply conflicted about it. He he sort of moves from one view to the other. He can't quite make up his mind.
He's not a historian. He's an author. He invents things also.
He's
he
an artist.
Things. He doesn't describe exactly what happened.
But it's this, I'm sorry, it's the ambivalence that makes it so interesting. Sorry.
He doesn't know at the beginning where he's going, or at least doesn't tell us. And it's only at the end that...
Right.
But what we have near the end actually is a description of his death, and I think symbolic of the death of the Jews outside, because right after he describes this whole custom, and by the way, there is music there, the custom of Moshe's death, the anniversary of Moshe's death, and of course Moshe never made it into the land of Israel. You have on 220, in the beginning of the last paragraph, it says, the Sha'at P'tirati, Netzah Kol Eidah Lelav Lototi. That's a very strong image of death and death.
Yeah, you're right. I missed that in the language, but you're 100% right.
So, and it's like the death of the Jew mired in the Gola, and the continuing on to life in Eretz Israel.
It's like he's saying the Galut is a graveyard.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the Holocaust. But I think he really missed the way that, because he's saying here at one point that happy is the converse that says.
Yeah, Shreshi and Shreshi.
Yeah. So I think he is, the ambivalence is there, because I think he does miss the old home, even though he is going to experience it.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah, that's right. I was
struck by
that. In the scene that you referred to where they're waiting for a minion, it's always a period of trepidation.
Yeah.
And so, if I remember right, two things happen. The Levite, Levi, dies, and they're waiting. The leader, Benjamin, is not there, but somebody else from the minion rises to the occasion to take his place.
The leader isn't aware that he's there.
Right.
The leader thinks if Shmuel Levi isn't here, we don't have a minion.
Yes.
But in fact, him being there is the one who makes the ten, and then he's able to continue. Because I'm there, I've known, therefore they're able to go on. And the leader is the one who goes on. As far as I don't think someone takes his place. I think the leader himself at some point realizes it. And then...
That's a way of him connecting to
the past.
His community.
Right. By being part of it.
Just passing through.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as everyone's sure, I'm thinking about my late mother, who came to Israel as a young woman and at times was talking about the way she grew up in Europe and all that. But when we had an opportunity to go for a trip to Europe to visit the places, she had no interest whatsoever to go there. And she did. So.
She left it behind.
But you also get the impression that once he leaves them, and they have they already have their doors ready for the coffin, and nobody's ever going to find that place. That once he leaves them, death will just slowly take them all away, and the community will start dying. Nobody will ever find them.
What page are you on? 220, the fourth line of the line, and he's looking back at them.
Yeah. Literally, it's the blue clouds of smoke coming from the train. It's the blue mists. The blue mists. He's not on the train yet. Raphael is a classic image that we find, which is associated sometimes with visions. Choshech Anan va'Arafel. Either imagery of a divine vision, or at times just vagueness and darkness and lack of clarity. Why the Kulim is an interesting one. That's
back to the priest again with the blue.
Well, there would. If he wanted to evoke the priest, I feel like he would have said chelet. Kachol is not a word that you would have.
This is exactly the way he saw them when he first encountered them in the mists. And that's why you wonder whether they're real or whether they're just.
And maybe the Kachol is imagining. And maybe what changes the Kachol, maybe it's Israel.
This is 1945.
His leaving.
It is definitely 1945.
I believe it's 45.
Oh, because that's, then it's very much tied to the Shoah, even though.
Yeah, does it say? Does it have a date?
It's published in. From my understanding, was it was published in 45.
Published 45. So this could be his reaction.
Want to show over that
question? It's like the Crusades are there, but.
Would you comment on the episode with this Dishag Dolar Maragona, who's like a prophet?
Where are we?
216, he finds her tombstone. And it's very evocative of the warnings that people in the Holocaust received and did not heed.
Right, Banish Varim, among the broken stones, right? So I saw the broken stones of the Matseva with the Pasuk Mishirashir. Right, I mean, the Brach Dodi is very clear. Yeah, Brach Dodi is, I mean, it is a piyut that's known, but is being used here as in run away. It's a message of flee. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know what it's based on, where he's, you know, what he's linking it to, or if this is something he's invented.
Any significance, Ma'ar Guna?
I'm sure there is significance.
Where is this?
On the bottom of 216, top of 217. He talks about finding a broken headstone from this woman, Marat Buna, who had been a poetess, and who after her death came in a dream to the leaders of the community and sang this song, which is, you know, a liturgical song, Brach Dodi, which literally Brach Dodi means flee, my beloved. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what she was talking about until, sure enough, the slaughter came to the community. But in terms of who this is, who this is modeled on, I don't know.
And Zev Jabotinsky, he also went to
Yes.
But it said
he was a novelist. So,
yeah.
But it could have been any of them.
He went to Europe and said, guys, get out of here.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. And he was a poet too. I think he wrote poetry too. Mm-hmm. So.
That's nice that he's allowing women to sing.
Well, it says that she composed Piyutim LeNashim. Mm-hmm. The Shimei Piyutim for the women. Oh, now, yeah. She then, in the dream, she sang for the Parnasei HaKehilah. So, hopefully that includes some males.
Oh, yeah, and the minhag that they did not speak during Yom Kippur, the whole day, even the women.
Yeah. Oh, and we have that in the
house. Even the women. Yeah.
We had it with Rabbi Sachs. That was a big issue, you know, about speaking in shul during this service.
I don't know, but there was a story that we did 2 times ago. What was it? Where he had the custom of not speaking
right. That
and
was
so he ended up by fasting 2 days, remember? Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, he mentions that. He drops these things in many places, you know, to remind people that to speak.
It was even very annoyed with women.
No, I think what he's talking about there is you have a tradition of what's called Ta'anit Dibur. There is such a tradition of, not on a fast day in particular, but just in general, a person taking on, in yeshivot it still goes on actually, primarily during the month of Elul, of people saying, I'm just not going to talk to people for the day. I'm gaining control of my speech. Well, that's supposed to be all the time.
I know.
But people saying, I feel like my speech is out of control and I'm going to get it under control. I'll rein myself in by not speaking for the day. Associating it with Yom Kippur certainly makes a lot of sense. And I think what he's saying probably reflects a reality that he was familiar with in Europe, which was that this is the sort of thing that would have been taken on by somebody in yeshiva. It's the sort of thing that may have been taken on by a male, but that he would have been surprised to see spread beyond men. And that's what he's commenting on. I think he's talking about, I don't think he's making a statement of his views about women. I think he's describing the reality in which he lived.
What's the longest they don't speak today? I'm curious, because
it's usually a one-day thing.
Oh, just one day.
It's a one-day thing.
It's not like those Venezuelan,
Well, if there are no more comments, I usually ask somebody to thank our speaker, and somehow today, I've been Badera. That's very appropriate.